Hello and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM-FM. My name is Eddie Lesher and I'll be joined very soon by our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. And this program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, and our guests take an in-depth and informative look into holistic, evidence-based approaches that can be integrated into daily life. And all our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, go to amindfulemergence.com. And I want to welcome our guests to A Mindful Emergence once again. This week, Margaret is not joining me. She's actually teaching yoga, but I am joined by two special guests, Jennifer Warren and Bobby Mickerson from Recovery Connections Community. And I'm really excited to talk about continuing care and peer support for recovery. So with that, I want to welcome into our studio first, Jennifer. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having us.
You bet. And Bobby Mickerson.
Hey, I'm happy to be here, Eddie. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, this is so exciting. You're doing great work out at Recovery Connection Community. And I was wondering if one or the other of you could kind of give us an overview. What can our listeners expect to hear about tonight?
Well, we're going to tell you a little bit about our program and what we're doing. We've been operating for 6 years, and our program is currently a 2-year program. We take men and women over age 18 that want to change their lives and have addiction issues and want to get their lives back on track, basically.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add to that, Bobby? Or?
I'm interested in talking a lot about peer support. We have that model. We inculcate that model in everyday life. And I want to talk about community, mm-hmm. most importantly.
So explain a little bit for our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, peer support. What does that actually mean?
It means, I'm going to jump in because I'm a certified peer support specialist. So is Jennifer. It's someone with lived experience, yeah. And giving support based upon that experience.
So you're not talking to people about something out of a book?
No.
No.
So both of you are very open about the fact that you are in recovery.
Absolutely.
For quite a while. Jennifer, you mentioned earlier, how long?
I've been clean and sober for 23 years.
23 years. And Bobby?
Yes. I'm still a baby. I've been clean. I will actually be clean 2 years on the 15th.
Wow. Well, 2 years is a big deal.
Yeah,
it's especially a big deal, yeah, in the work that we're doing. And it's so important because we really have an epidemic now, don't we?
Yes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're feeling a critical need. Are you from this area, Jennifer?
I was born in California and moved around a bit. Raleigh was home before I came to Asheville in 1999. So I've been here about 18 years, and I love the area. Actually, Black Mountain is where I'm from now, and I've built my family here.
So you got clean in California?
No, I left California when I was 9.
Oh.
I got clean in my addiction. Really, I really kind of went downhill in Alabama after I was in graduate school there. And then I came back to North Carolina to get clean, and I went through a long-term program that our recovery program is based on, and graduated from that program out of Winston-Salem.
Mm-hmm. So what was the moment of clarity for you? What helped you turn the corner so that you were able to finally find a path of recovery?
Well, I was in, my mom flew in. She had found out about my using and addiction and came in, flew into Alabama and put me into a 30-day program. And while I was there.
Were you happy about that?
Oh, no.
No.
In fact, I left and ended up making a side trip there and got arrested and ended up going back on my own at that point.
So we had two interventions here, mom and
that's right,
and the law enforcement officer.
That's right. And so the outreach program came out, and I went into their program, and while I was there, I realized that I was not going to likely go back to my condo and be clean and sober. Either I was going to want to celebrate, or I was going to be depressed, and I would call someone, and I would again start using, and I knew I needed something more.
Because you were in a 30-day program?
I was in a 30-day program in Alabama, and then I went into a long-term program in Winston-Salem, a two-year program.
Yeah, because 30 days isn't enough.
30 days is not enough.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
And Bobby, what about you? Give us some background on your history, if you would.
Well, I'm a little bit from everywhere. I was born in Jamaica. I was born in Jamaica, in a little town called Spanish Town, Jamaica. And so,
Jamaica, man.
Yeah, mine. It is. Irie, you know. And then what happened was, in my dad ended up getting a job in New York because times got a little hard in Jamaica. And so he moved us to New York, which I hated.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 12. I was about to turn 13. It was the summer, 92. And so I was pretty upset until I got to New York. And then I'm like, this melting pot of culture and trouble was there. So I stayed in New York until I graduated high school. And then I ended up going to North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, and getting a bachelor's in computer science.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Were you using at that point?
Yeah. I probably started drinking when I turned 14. And then, let's see, I followed up with all kind of other things in my 20s in college. And my life became really unmanageable. I lost my marriages. Two marriages. I lost my family, for the most part, the respect of my family, and plus legal issues too. And so, yeah.
But somehow you managed to get through school, or did all that? Did a lot of the wreckage happen after you got your degree?
A lot of the wreckage happened after the degree. I didn't pay attention to how dangerous the addiction was. I knew it was prevalent. I knew it was there. I knew also mental health too. I knew there were issues there, but I ignored them because I thought, quote unquote, I was normal. Everybody else was functioning, still doing what they were doing, and they seemed to be living okay lives. Why am I unmanageable? I can fix it. I can fix it, and that's usually the tone of every addict anyway.
Sure, sure. No problem. I got this.
Okay.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. That's exactly. Until you crash, and you crash hard.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes the term comes up, hitting bottom, but it's different for different people, isn't it, Jennifer?
I agree.
Yeah, for some people, bottom is living under the bridge, the stereotypical image of an addict. But for some people, it's getting a dent in their BMW because they had one too many.
Yes.
Right.
They didn't even have to get a DUI.
Right.
That's when the moment of clarity happens.
Right.
It takes different things for different people, absolutely.
Different people, yeah. But there has to be that willingness, that motivation.
Yes. Sometimes that doesn't come right away, even when people want to come in the program. You know, it takes them a while to really be willing to do whatever it takes to get their lives together.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM-FM and WPVM-FM.org. And I'm joined in the studio this week by Jennifer Warren and Bobby Mickerson from Recovery Connections Community. And the theme is continuing care and peer support services for recovery. So you went through a long-term program, Jennifer.
Yes.
Bobby, did you have that same opportunity, or was it just a short-term treatment?
Well, no. In the beginning, I went to, it was like a 14-day treatment process, and of course, it didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, you're barely detoxed, right? If at all.
Right. Well, at least I thought it would work for me. And yeah. I'm like, 14 days, I'm cured. I'm good. I'm good. So I'm back out there. And no, I needed more. I needed more. So I was provided the opportunity to come to Recovery Connections. And that's where I met Jennifer, and I met our operations director, Philip Warren. And that's when the journey started, man. Uh-huh. It did.
So you're a graduate of this program, if you can use the word. Is graduate a fair term?
He's actually going to be officially graduated this Saturday. We're having a family program, and at the end of the program, we're graduating three people, and Bobby's one of them.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Good for you, Bobby.
Yeah.
But, you know, for those of you listening, you didn't have the benefit of seeing the smile on this man's face.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep, it's a good day. And you know what? The term we're actually using is we're graduating from early recovery, because recovery is forever.
It is.
Yes. You know, and it's work. And so it's just it's an accomplishment, but we got to keep working.
Yeah.
And so that's what we do. We talk about.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because to such a large degree, recovery is looked at as an acute illness, a short-term solution required. But it's really a chronic illness, isn't it, Jennifer?
Yes. We've spent years and years developing this addiction, and it takes a lot of years to turn it around. And really, we have to have the tools that we need across time, because we hit bumps in the road, and the habit that we've developed is to go back to using. It happens all the time. So it's difficult for people to really remember to use their tools,
mm-hmm.
And to use their support system. And that's what we're all about, is building community around a person so that they have what they need and who they need to go to.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Community is so key.
Yes.
Yeah. I agree. And like, to piggyback off of Jennifer, I always use the concept of someone who's a diabetic. You know, I mean, I know some diabetics who are more healthier than I am. It's because they keep in shape. They take their insulin. They eat correctly. And it's the same way with addiction. It's a chronic illness. And in order for us to be able to keep up our wellness, we have to have community. We have to have the tools. But they travel down the same lane, And we want people to understand that. And that's how we break stigma, too, Eddie. That's how we break stigma.
So what I failed to do is mention what your roles are there. Jennifer, you're the president and CEO and founding director.
That's right.
You have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, CPSS.
Certified peer support.
Oh, I have one of those, and I didn't even recognize it. That's why it looked familiar.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Ding, ding.
And then... Bobby, your role is public relations liaison. You're also a peer support specialist, and I see you're involved in the CSAC program.
Mm-hmm.
Enrolled, registered, certified substance abuse counselor,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, we have the same letters after our name, because I'm also a CSAC-R.
Oh, wow.
As well.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I haven't taken my test yet.
Yeah.
My clinical supervisor says, Eddie, you got to take the test.
Yeah. Well,
I haven't gotten around to it. Are you as scared as I am?
Yeah, I am. I was, just matter of fact, was talking about that today.
Okay.
So, yeah.
We'll get there. Okay. So going back to the issue of community, I know for me personally, when I was in my active addiction, I isolated.
Yes.
Do you find that to be true
lot? Yes.
Absolutely.
And you can be isolated in a room full of people, or a family around you, or people around you. You isolate yourself. You don't interact with people. You, you know, keep yourself very separate and very self-focused, self-centered in active addiction.
And talk about shame, the role that that plays.
To me, that's probably one of the main keys to addiction, is the shame. And once people feel that shame, then it's hard for them to reach out for the help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think it's peer support specialists. We're supposed to help them get through the shame.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end,
how do you
of the
do
day,
that, Bobby? How do you help them get through the shame as a peer support specialist?
By being relatable, letting them know that, listen, I've been through it too, man.
Yeah.
I know exactly the emotion that you're feeling, you know, but then I guide them towards the way of saying, listen, this is the road I've taken. These are some of the tools I've used. Let me share a few with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Creating space for people to feel their feelings, identify their feelings.
Yeah.
So often we don't even recognize what we're feeling. We've covered up stuff. We've been taught in our families of origin not to talk about issues, not to talk about problems, to keep things secret. We're only sick as our secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So being very transparent is important. Surrendering is important.
Right.
Things that we don't do in active addiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So I had a question and it just popped right out of my head. So I've got to come up with something else. Talk about recovery-oriented systems of care. This is a term now that's being used, and I know it's part of your program. Along the theme of long-term recovery and community, I was wondering if you could talk about what ROSC, as it's often referred to, is and how it's part of your program.
I think of it as the holistic piece and the continuum, that we're providing lots of different pathways, lots of different ways within our program to get to a recovering lifestyle. Also partnering with other resources and other programs. We are not a treatment program. We are for people that have already done treatment. They've already done other things and they've not been successful, so they are coming in to the program to learn how to live life on life's terms, mm-hmm. and they need the support of other people that are trying to do that too.
So people that come to you, they already have a little bit of clean time or sobriety?
In many cases, or maybe they don't have any at that time, but they've tried treatment many different times. And so now they recognize that it's more than an education class or, a timeout for 7 days or 30 days or whatever it is, that it's actually coming in and doing the hard work to change the habits mm-hmm. that we have relied on for so long.
I mean, a lot of the individuals that come through, not necessarily even me, but they're chronic, I'm going to use the term relapsers or return to users,
yes.
the use. I would like to, for my messaging training, Eddie.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we usually get the individual who has tried multiple pathways sometimes, and they just can't get it.
Yeah.
It's just not happening.
And there seems to be a lot of shame around, and again, the term that's common is relapse, but, you know, when people return to use again and again, that really generates a lot of shame, doesn't it?
Right.
And hopelessness.
Right.
They feel like they can't ever get it. They're not ever going to be successful at being, you know, that term normal, at being a regular member of society. And so it's hard. Sometimes it's really, really hard. I mean, one of the reasons that I do what I do is because I wanted to offer a place, offer the same opportunity that I was given back in 1994. So I wanted to have a place for people to come back to. So that's kind of been my niche, is being the one at the other end of the phone where people can call. And, you know, we're pretty non-traditional mm-hmm. and I'll go to where someone's using and get them
really?
From where
you've done
they
that?
Are. Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Many, many times.
Yeah.
Paint that picture.
Well,
I know it's not pretty.
I mean, I have developed some strong connections with people in the program that I've been in recovery with. And they have gone back out and they're calling me and crying, and they want to do something different, and they don't really know how to get out of that situation, and they're, you know, sitting in the bar or sitting in the crack house. And I'm like, give me the address and tell me where you're at.
Hmm.
And I have gone out and gotten people and brought them back to the program. So I, you know, that's something that I feel like is really kind of my responsibility. They are somebody that I've known their deepest hearts, you know, what they want in their lives and their pain and their stories. And they've shared that with me and I know it. And so when they call me, I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a calling for me and it's a mission for me. And that's what I've always done.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just showing up gives them hope. Some, at least one person cares. Yeah. One person believes in me.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And return to use, it's not a requirement. It's not, you know, some people pick up one white chip or one white key tag and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very common. Why is this so difficult for people to get clean or sober, whatever term you prefer? Why is it so hard for them to stay in recovery?
People stop doing what they have learned to do. They go back into the world. They don't go to meetings. They don't talk to their friends in recovery. They get busy at their jobs. They get busy with their family. And they stop doing what got them to the point of being clean. Then their thinking kicks in, and resentments are a lot of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Negative thinking, hopelessness, just in their daily living. I mean, life is hard. And so then the answer is, and they find themselves driving by where they used to get high or the liquor store, or they're just walking through the grocery store and they go ahead and, you know, pick up. A lot of times return to use is about alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they think, if as long as I'm not using heroin, I'm good.
Right.
Because I can go drink a beer.
That wasn't my drug
or
of
go
addiction.
Gambling.
Right. That wasn't
yes.
my problem.
That's
that wasn't
right.
my drug of addiction.
Yeah.
You notice I don't use the term drug of choice either, by the way.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Because there isn't a choice, really. The
right.
brain is still hijacked, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I truly believe, Eddie, that addiction, I mean, is not a choice, but recovery is a choice.
Yeah.
And so when people end up returning to use, well, they subtract themselves from community, because the community is the key. It's the key. Staying connected with you and Jennifer and all my peer brothers and peer sisters and NA meetings and AA meetings and that whole community, that's the key. That's the tool. And so as soon as they subtract themselves, then they think it's okay for the one beer is all right.
Yeah.
It's all right.
And it seems, I've heard this from a number of people, that there's a danger zone, particularly when people get to about 8 to 10 months.
Right.
A lot of them think, okay, I'm healed, I'm cured,
yeah.
I'm over the hump. One, oh yeah, I'm at a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, and then of course people are putting pressure.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Because other people don't understand.
I still get asked, well, mm-hmm. let's see, you've been clean all these years. I mean, you can have a beer here and there, can't you? I go, no.
Right.
And it's hard to explain to them. I don't even try much. I just say, no, I can't do that.
Right.
And honestly, I don't want to, because
right.
not only am I likely to just go into that downward spiral again, but I'm really not interested in clouding my thinking anymore.
Right.
I like
right.
the mental clarity that I have when I'm not
putting
a chemical in there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break. I've got a piece of music. And when we come back, I want to dig into the program and talk about, you've got a community phase, foundation phase, lifestyle phase, all these different phases, and really talk about all the different things that you're doing there. And at Recovery Connections Community. So we'll do that after the break. But I want to remind our listeners, this is A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're going to return with our guests after a brief musical pause, talking about community, really. Somebody watching over me. That's community, is we're watching
yes.
over our each other.
That's right. Right.
And it's a piece of music by Maria Mulder.
Somebody was watching.
Yeah, wow. Bringing it home. WPVM-FM. Somebody is watching over me, Maria Mulder. Great track and very timely piece of music based on the theme. This week, Jennifer Warren and Bobby Mickerson from Recovery Connections Community talking about continuing care and peer support services for recovery. Before we return to our guests, just want to mention a couple of things. First of all, this is Eddie Lesher, and from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM, Margaret Kirshner is usually here, and we're joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in an effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. and Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m., all our past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. You can easily locate them by selecting this program number 63 from the schedule at WPVMFM.org. So you just go to that website, click on the schedule, find the show. It's listed Mondays at 7, and you'll find all the programs that you can listen to at your leisure. And all our programs are made possible by A Mindful Emergence, LLC, an Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, retreats, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. And you can find out more about them online at amindfulemergence.com, as well as you'll find them on Facebook and LinkedIn. And I want to mention, if you enjoy this show, there are a couple of other programs that are fairly similar in intention. One is called Wild Heart, and that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. with Laura Elliott. And Laura brings on guests from all walks of life, sharing their passions, stories, and ways of life to inspire the freedom of heart. And then on Thursdays, you can join McNair Ezard at 5 p.m. He's hosting A Better World, and that show looks at people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger, poverty, economic and social justice, the environment, and spirituality. And he interviews people who are making a difference. I also wanted to mention an educational forum that is being hosted by NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And that's coming up Thursday, March 9th at 6 p.m. And it's called In Our Own Voice. And this is a two-person team that NAMI offers of trained presenters. These are people living in recovery from mental illness, and they use their individual stories to unmask what it's like to live with mental illness and stay in recovery. So it's a life-changing NAMI program. You can learn all about it. There'll be a visual presentation discussion. So that's at 356 Biltmore Avenue at the NAMI office, March 9th at 6 p.m. So I wanted to make sure that our listeners know about that. So we're going to return back now to our guests, Jennifer and Bobby from Recovery Connections Community. So you've got three locations. Where are they located?
We have our main men's house is on Old Fort Road in Fairview, and we have a house that has been kind of transitional housing, but we've brought some women up, and so that's in East Asheville. And the majority of our women and some of our other men are in Anger at what we call the farm, which is southeast of Raleigh.
Mm-hmm. And you have the ability to house about 40 people,
yes,
in your residential program. So what happens? Tell us, like, if someone is interested in coming in to your program, how does that work? What's the process, Bobby?
Well, generally, you can go to the website, www.recoveryconnectionscommunity.com, click on the admissions tab, and there we have an application. And on that application, what it's going to do is ask you various questions. You're going to fill them out in detail, and then we ask you to write a 2 to 3 page autobiography about yourself, about what led you up to the point that you're seeking long-term help. And then once that's faxed to the intake coordinator, someone will get back with you to do a phone screening or a phone interview. And that generally lasts about 30, 45 minutes or so, just depends. And we explain in detail what the program's about.
Okay. And do you normally have a waiting list, or how's that? work?
We don't have a waiting list. We have opened houses as needed, and mm-hmm. so we have reached the 40. We've never been up to full capacity, okay. so we have
so that's good
beds
news.
Available.
Because a lot of places, yeah. you know, they'll say, well, we just don't have a bed for you.
Right.
And when you're in need, you're in need.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want to hear that. It's like, well, we'll get back to you when we've got a bed.
Right. Because you've got to get them, respond to them in that moment.
Carpe diem.
Yes.
Yeah, because, you know, the latest figure, and I've heard various statistics, but the last figure I heard is that 91 people a day are dying from opioid overdose
yeah.
in this country.
Oh, it's huge. The you know, people go and they have some kind of pain issue and they'll go to a doctor and they'll get put on some opiate and they get addicted to it. And when they can't, you know, either the doctors say no more or they're wanting to use more, then they go to the streets and they're getting heroin that is now mixed with fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
And fentanyl, talk about that. That's an extremely powerful drug, isn't
right.
it?
Right, yeah. And so people are eating fentanyl patches. They're taking fentanyl patches and, you know, getting overdosing.
Yeah.
Overdosing on them.
And when people return to use, you know, they've used a certain, they're used to a certain amount. And then maybe they're clean for a while. And when they go back out, they'll use that same amount. But the body can't handle it, can it?
No.
Right.
No.
So even though before they were able to use that amount, this time they overdose.
Right.
Happens a lot, doesn't
Happens
it?
Happens a lot. And yeah. also alcohol with benzodiazepines
oh,
is another one that's killing people.
Yeah, benzos and alcohol. Are you seeing many people come in with methamphetamine issues?
That was very prevalent in our area more like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now opiates are coming back. 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, it was crack cocaine and cocaine.
Yeah.
And heroin was very low. And then when I started, I was a founder of another program, methamphetamine was the thing. And now it's really the opiates is yeah. very big.
Cuts across all races.
Does not discriminate.
All social right. stratas.
Does not discriminate.
Does not. And it's deadly. Okay, so people now have done the phone interview. There's a bed open and they're saying, yes, I want to do this. What happens next, Bobby?
Well, we'll meet them at our office location. And then we'll take them to the facility, and then we have an intake process at that point where we go over some of the expectations, some of the rules and regulations. We talk about work because we are a work program, which is also explained in the phone interview also. And so the work program, it helps you pay your way through the program, build strong work ethic, some of the things that you lose when you're in active addiction. And so you get ready to start your journey. Once you start doing that intake process, that's when your journey really begins. So once you do that, then we kind of show you around the facility, let you meet some of the peers, and then.
So you're working on site, or do you have placement with people outside, businesses?
No, we have employers outside or outside contracts.
Okay.
And so.
Recovery Allies.
Yes,
yes I've heard
exactly.
That. Right.
Exactly.
These are businesses that say, you know what, I'm willing to invest in the future
yes.
by bringing people in who are making an effort to get free of their addiction.
Yes. Right. And we have some really great partners that have worked with us and are willing to hire. They hire the organization. And so the individual doesn't get the job. They're there as volunteers working. The money that's made comes back into the program to support the program as a whole.
How hard was it to find these kind of businesses?
It, you know, sometimes we've had some luck with with businesses, but others don't really understand. They want that particular person. They don't understand that they're hiring a pool of people, mm-hmm. and they get attached to the individual person. When we have good management that works with us, that really helps, because the people that are working with our residents day to day, our residents sometimes, you know, everybody's trying to find that easy way out.
Yeah.
And so they want to go home with somebody mm-hmm. and develop intimate relationships.
Boy, that's dangerous, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
We see that happen.
Yes.
So this is the community phase that they're in initially?
That's right.
Okay. And so that's really the first phase. So you're becoming familiar with your surroundings, other residents, and so on. Starting to work.
Mm-hmm.
Going to meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, is that optional or required to go to 12-step meetings? Or encouraged? How would you describe that?
People follow the daily schedule, so mm-hmm. they go in that first phase especially. But the first 6 months, everybody kind of does the same thing as everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's when you stay longer than that, which we're now going to a open-ended program mm-hmm. so that people can make a 6-month commitment and then choose to stay on after that. We're trying to kind of give power back to the people and meet the people where they're at, because it's so hard for people to make a commitment to come into a program for 2 years.
Yeah.
And there's some detox, 7-day, 30-day programs, and then there's some 2-year programs, and there's not a lot in between that.
Right.
And so we're gonna try to fill that niche a little mm-hmm. bit.
So after your community phase, you have a foundation phase.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they should really have a pretty good feel for what's happening.
That's exactly what that phase is about. You've already gotten acclimated to the program. You know who your peers are. You're developing some relationships. And now at this phase, I always say the ball starts to roll a little bit, because you gain more responsibilities in the house. You get a little bit more privileges. You may get to sleep an hour later, things of that nature. You earn your way through mm-hmm. the whole program. Everything is privileged. Everything, you earn a privilege back. And so once you get the foundation, that's when those privileges kind of start being extended to you.
And when you get to that point, you start playing an active role in supporting the newcomers, aren't you?
A helps B and A gets better.
Exactly.
It's about service work. When we get outside of ourselves and learn how to reach out and take care of the new person, then we're doing good work.
I remember my sponsor told me that, because I'm involved in 12-step, he said that the spiritual transformation that takes place going through the steps is making the shift from being I-focused, it's all about me, to being outwardly service-focused, thinking about other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it seems like whether you're in 12-step or not, if you have successful recovery, that really needs to happen, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's how people often, how they stay clean after the program, is giving back, finding ways to look out for other people and be there for other people and giving back to the people in the community as well.
Yeah. We can only keep it by giving it away.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the foundation phase. And then when you get to about 6 months, we enter, and I'm getting this off your website.
Right.
And give the website again, if you would, Jennifer.
It's www.recoveryconnectionscommunity.com.
We're very straightforward. So now at 6 months, we're in the lifestyle phase. Talk about that.
That's really more of when you may be named a leader in the house, and so you actually kind of have earned a title, and then people come to you and talk to you about their issues and their problems. We sit in with people when they make phone calls home, go on local family visits. That's when we start really focusing on rebuilding the relationship with the families
right.
that we've damaged those relationships so much.
And it's a good thing that it is up to 6 months before you start reestablishing those relationships again, because if you were like my parents, were like anybody else's parents, they didn't need to hear from me for a little while. They did. They needed a break.
They needed to heal.
They needed to heal themselves. And so during the duration of the 6 months, then I got a chance to be able to show that I had some commitment by being somewhere for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time it was time to reach out to mom or dad or whoever the case may be, then they're a little more open to hear about what you've been doing.
Do you have programs where the family actually comes and engages them?
We have a couple of family days, and now we're starting this family education group. We're having one this Saturday, and it'll be about a four-hour group where the families will come. We'll provide them some education on addiction, on recovery, and the program, have lunch with them, serve them lunch, and then have a process group where the families can kind of say what they need to say to the resident in the program, and the resident may have some things they need to say to their family members.
Mm-hmm. So critical. Mm-hmm. I was at a conference a couple of weekends ago, and a gentleman was doing a presentation, and he said, if you don't treat the family and you just treat the individual, the likelihood of success is greatly lessened.
Mm-hmm.
It's a system. You know, when the person changes, the whole rest of the family, you know, everything shifts. So that, you know, takes some education and some work with the families as well.
Especially
sure.
because addiction is very possibly been present with other members of that family.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And it may have been or may not been. And so I think this group is really, it'll be really great to probably address stigma too. And break some of the stigma that's associated with someone who has an addiction and maybe some mental health challenges. So they're able to explain and educate the parent or whoever the family member may be that, listen, you know, I'm not the guy that was underneath the bridge. I'm your son. I'm your daughter. This is who I am. So
how hard is it to get that trust back, Bobby?
It takes a while. It does. Me and my family, our relationship is really good now. But it took a good 18 months before we got to the point where we had relevant conversations. Whether it was about, instead of our conversations weren't about what you're not doing, it was about what I am doing.
Yeah.
Now, so.
You know, it's funny. I was talking with one young man, and he had, I think, you know, maybe 6 months or so, which is great.
Right.
You know, that's a big deal. They had 6 months, and he couldn't understand why his father still wouldn't lend him his car.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of other examples. Oh, well, he was actually going for counseling, and his parents were writing the checks out. Like, here's the check for this week, here's the check for the next week. Rather than giving him cash.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And he goes, geez, I've been clean 6 months. What's the problem here? They don't trust me.
This time. Right, yeah.
But so bringing the family in is so critical just for that reason alone, mm-hmm. as well as for all the other things that you point out. Did you ever find situations where the family is pushing, if you will, someone to get help, but then when they get their life straightened out, and they really, really start doing well, the family somehow resents it, or there's a dynamic. Do you know where I'm understanding what I'm saying?
Because it's been set up that their role in whatever it is that they were doing for the addict has been set up, and they've not been in, you know, a program for 18 months or 2 years. And sometimes they really forget that just however long ago their son was facing 42 misdemeanors and you know, getting kicked out of other programs, and they forget that, and so then they're mad, you know, at us or whatever, because their son can't spend the whole weekend with them,
or they used to play the role of the rescuer or the enabler,
right,
and their, let's say, son was the screw up.
Yes.
And now that he's got it together, they don't know how to act.
Right.
Right. Right. Yep. They don't know what role they play now, you know, instead of just being mom and dad.
Yeah. Exactly.
Dysfunctional family roles. Yes.
Yeah. So all that's part of the dynamic. That's why it's so important to have everybody involved. So in this lifestyle phase, people are really starting to get a deep understanding of a lot of the personal issues that they had, too, and a lot of the skills. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the skills that you find that people pick up that are helpful to them at this point.
Well, really, it's it's we refer to it as milieu therapy, and what it is, it's role modeling. And so there's like five P's, and people learn how to talk to other people, that's plugging in, and they learn how to pull someone up and say, you're not supposed to be doing that, that's setting boundaries. Mm-hmm. And then you pass, you go tell somebody, hey, this is what's gone on. So mm-hmm. you learn to tell on yourself and the other people around you, and not in a negative way. It's learning assertiveness skills. Mm-hmm. And then participating in our groups and our just daily activities at the house. Mm-hmm. All of that is really essential. And those skills are what people are learning. And they're practicing that on a daily basis so that down the road they can say, hey, you know, because the little things lead to the big things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if we make it okay to, you know, take a nap when we're supposed to be working, or take an extra cigarette break, you know, then, and we're with someone else and they make it okay for us, then, you know, they're, mm-hmm. we're giving each other passes, and we're not speaking up for ourselves and for the other people around us.
Are people getting drug tested while they're out there? Do they have to do the UAs?
Yeah, we have random drug screens.
Mm-hmm. Kind of have to do that, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right, so we've got the lifestyle phase, 6 to 12 months, and then you have what's called a preparation phase. So this is where you start really putting a lot of these tools more into action, huh? And in your community, in your own life?
Yes. We're trying to really kind of teach people, prepare people in that phase to get ready to, because in the next phase, they're going to get their own job, and they're going to have money in their pocket, and they're going to be seeing their family on a regular basis. And there's lots of triggers in all of that. In some cases, people are getting into romantic relationships, and we're doing all the things that people in life do, and we have to take on each one mm-hmm. of those things and be able to successfully.
Do they have their own car at this point, possibly?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
That's in the last phase.
The last phase, society phase.
Yes.
Aftercare, 18 to 24 months, the most critical stage of development. Why is it the most critical stage, Bobby, would you say?
Probably, well, to me, really, the community phase and the society phase are probably the most important phases, because at the 18 to 24 month phase, now you got a little more freedom. Mm-hmm. You have a little more freedom to be able to go out and do things. As Jennifer mentioned, you're able to get a job. You're able to have some money in your pocket. And so it's easy to develop an I don't need to be told what to do anymore type of attitude. Real easy. Resentments get built. They do. They do real fast. And before you know it, you've caught yourselves distancing yourself from the community before you even know it, just floating away. And so it's real critical at this point that we stay really connected. That's why we have to stay really involved with giving back and helping out with the groups that we have, the in-house groups, and really staying connected. Because at this point, you know, in your mind, you're saying, okay, I'm almost done. It's about time to go.
No, you're not done.
I got it. I'm cured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. When I talk to people who are getting ready to leave some of the programs that Margaret and I are involved with, and I'll say, so you're going home now. How do you feel? I would rather hear them say, you know, I'm a little scared, I'm a little nervous, than to say, oh, man, I am ready.
Got it.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good to be a little nervous.
That's right.
Because it's a big change.
Yeah.
You do animal and equine therapy.
Ooh, that's my thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The animal therapy in our program, what that means is we learn how to be responsible and care for animals. And we have the farm, and we have a variety of animals, and sometimes it is so peaceful, and you know, we learn how to interact with the animals and get healing.
So what do you have out there?
Oh, we have everything from pigs and llamas and goats and horses to rabbits and guinea pigs and dogs and cats.
Well,
and
I'll tell you this. Well, see, I'm from Brooklyn, and, you know, we didn't have animals. We had big rats, but we didn't have any animals. So when I went to the farm, I'm like, I can't do this. I'm not dealing with any poop. I'm not dealing with any of that. But you got to understand, Eddie, you have to understand this. This was probably during one of my darkest moments in the program. I was having a really difficult time. And so when I got there, I had a horse. It was Avalon. I had to do the barn every Wednesday. It was my job to do the barn. So it was my job to feed Avalon. And so I will be crying, like, Avalon, you got to get me out of here. You got to get me out of here. And Avalon will look at me, and sometimes I think he even speak back to me. And at the end of the day, Avalon just needed to be fed, and that was good for me because at the time I didn't feel like I can speak to anyone else, but I spoke to a horse.
Yeah.
And it was therapeutic. It was.
Back in December, we had Shannon Knapp come by.
Yeah.
And she talked about trauma-focused equine-assisted psychotherapy, and that was a great show. And I learned so much. It never occurred to me. I was never exposed to anything like that. Just how powerful that can be.
It is.
Oh yeah.
It is.
It's transformational, really.
And you have dogs out there,
and we've got dogs. Yeah. Right.
Now, are these rescue animals? Most of them.
Some.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's great. And so some of the other programs that you have, community support groups and resources, they do volunteer service out in the community?
Yes.
Where might they go?
Well, we have some relationships with folks that have been there for us and provide some Christian Bible study, and we've gone out and cleaned houses and volunteered in shops and things like
Christmas
that.
Christmas trees, things of that nature.
Yeah. Vocational training?
Yep, that happens in our job contracts. People are building skills as they are earning the income. We're about to open a restaurant.
Oh, really?
Yes. Right. And it's called Community Jamaican Cafe.
No, but listen, I'm going to put some jerk chicken in there.
All right. Look out. I'm coming down.
Yeah. Well, it's down in Irwin.
Where's that?
It's
right next to Anger.
Oh, well, that's a bit of a drive. But yeah, I do go down to Raleigh.
You're welcome.
Once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime. You got to come
20,
see the farm.
30 minutes from Raleigh.
Yeah. I'd love to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you're opening a restaurant.
That's right.
So they're going to have to run it.
That's right.
Right.
Well, that's the reason we're doing it. We have this guy that's been around for a long time. That's what he wants to do, and we want to keep him connected.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a restaurant for him, and he's going to run it and employ the people in the program.
Wow, that is fantastic. I mean, do you actually know what kind of food? Is it just going to be kind of a general?
We're going to do a lot of soups and sandwiches and all-day breakfast. We're going to do a breakfast-lunch thing down there.
Okay.
And we're going to be open on Sundays, too, which is good in that area because nothing in that area is open for lunch on Sundays.
Oh, well, you're going to definitely be filling a need. Any last-minute comments, anything that's really important that you want to say before we wrap up the show?
I mean, more than anything, I wanted to express, first, my thank you to Jennifer. Because, Eddie, you have to understand, when we talk about peer support and peer ran, well, Jennifer's pretty much the definition of that because she always keeps her door open for individuals like me. Because I don't know what may happen to me in the future, but I know if something happens to me in recovery, then I can come back and gain it back. I can gain it back. So it's very important. Community is very important to me. I can't stress that enough about the importance of sticking around and staying connected and realizing what you have at the moment.
Wow. We're very well put, Bobby. That really sums it up. Thanks so much to both of you, Jennifer Warren and Bobby Mickerson from Recovery Connections Community. And folks, make sure you tune in next week. We're going to have Dan Grinnell, and he's going to be with C3 RHA Peer Living Room talking about vital connection for recovery. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.